a little nervous and a little concerned and a little worried. They don't want to be left holding an incomplete application, and they want to see the information in the reports, not just the reassurance.
Concern over deadlines for Alaska Gas Line applications. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, measuring benzene levels in Anchorage.
There's still the concern that there might be an association between cancer or leukemia and the benzene in the air.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Alaska lawmakers say Federal Energy Regulatory Commission officials are worried TransCanada might miss an October 2012 deadline to submit an application to build a natural gas pipeline to the lower 48. TransCanada, which is working with Exxon, was granted a state license and the promise of $500 million in state subsidies under the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act. The state anticipates paying TransCanada more than $100 million by July. Legislators in Washington, D.C. this week for the annual Energy Council conference discussed the project with the head of FERC. Fairbanks Senator Joe Pascavan says he's concerned about delays in some application pre-filings.
They were very explicit that FERC is not bound by the AGIA statutes, and if a completed application is not in by October 2012, that the application will be rejected.
But Larry Pursley, federal coordinator for Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Projects, says the most important thing for TransCanada is submitting the application by October 2012. Even if it isn't complete by then, Pursley says the project will still be fine. FERC will have a year to do a draft environmental impact statement for the project once the completed application is submitted.
It's not like it gets rejected and that's the end of it. It's like filing any other application, you got to give more information. Hopefully, they will turn in a complete one. But yes, FERC's a little nervous and a little concerned and a little worried. They don't want to be left holding an incomplete application, and they want to see the information in the reports, not just the reassurance.
State House Speaker Mike Chenault of Nikiski introduced legislation this session to scrap AGIA on the presumption that TransCanada hasn't been able to attract enough interest in the project from oil and gas shippers. So far, the company has not released details of its open season process from last year when it sought shipping commitments. Senate Finance Committee co-chair Bert Stedman of Sitka said he'd rather give the process another year.
Hopefully, between now and next winter, it'll give the governor an opportunity to start negotiating our way out of that contract if it does seem like a dead end. But I think it's a little premature to expect the legislature to jump in and drop the hammer.
Nearly half of the legislature is in Washington this week for the Energy Council, which brings together lawmakers from energy-producing states. Some critics say the annual trip is a waste of money and prevents the legislature from working on important issues during the session. Alaska will host an Energy Council conference in September in Anchorage. Two state lawmakers say the state should force major oil companies to declare their Alaska profits. Anchorage Representatives Pete Peterson and Les Guerra have authored the Truth in Alaska Oil Company Profits Act. It's aimed at ExxonMobil, the world's largest and most profitable oil company. Exxon is the only major oil company operating in the state which withholds that information. Under federal law, companies must report profits made within the U.S., but Alaska law uses a formula to estimate in-state profits for corporate income tax reporting, and those numbers are confidential. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission requires reporting if enough profits come from a particular region. That's one reason ConocoPhillips Alaska profits are known. British law requires BP to release its annual Alaska profits. Guerra says ExxonMobil is diversified enough that under federal law, it doesn't have to reveal Alaska profits.
We know Conoco has earned over $7.5 billion in profits in Alaska in the last 4 years. We know that British Petroleum has earned over $7 billion in the last 3 years. They haven't yet revealed their 2010 numbers. Probably that'll bring it over $9 billion. So with $17 billion of profits from Alaska oil production going to BP and Conoco, we don't find it credible that Exxon says they're not making enough money here.
The legislature is considering Governor Parnell's proposal to give oil companies bigger tax credits. Guerra calls it the biggest tax rollback in state history. At current prices of more than $100 per barrel, the state could lose an estimated $2 billion a year in oil revenues. Peterson says to maintain a fair balance between the industries and Alaska's royalty share, the state needs a company's profit information.
It's our oil, and we are required by our Constitution to get the most from our resources, and I believe Alaskans deserve to know how much profit is being made from the oil that's produced on our leases.
The legislation would require any company receiving more than $50 million in Alaska oil tax credits or producing more than 75,000 barrels of oil per day to make quarterly reports of its Alaska profits. Governor Parnell says he hasn't seen the legislation yet, but he says it could be a slippery slope.
You know, are they going to do that to every business in Alaska that pays corporate income taxes?
The legislation will be assigned to committee on Monday. The governor says he'll withhold final judgment on the bill until he sees it. Right now, Guerra and Peterson, both Democrats, are the only sponsors of the legislation, but they believe Republican co-signers will be forthcoming. Guerra believes it would be hard for any legislator to say Exxon should be allowed to hide their Alaska profits. For some time now, gasoline sold in Anchorage and Alaska has contained a higher benzene level than most of the United States. But that situation changes in 2012 when new federal regulations take effect that lowers the permissible benzene content from about 5% to around 1%. As a first step to measure the effectiveness of that change, Anchorage's Department of Health and Human Services has just completed a year-long study of current outdoor and indoor benzene levels. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The concern over benzene arises from studies indicating that some industrial workers exposed to high levels showed increased instances of cancer, most notably leukemia. According to Steve Morris of Anchorage's Health and Human Services Department, the impact of normal outdoor and home benzene levels and leukemia is not as clear.
There's still the concern that there might be association between cancer or leukemia and benzene in the air.
Morris oversaw a year-long study that measured both exterior and interior levels of benzene in Anchorage. The exterior air quality survey took place in the city's Airport Heights neighborhood. He said they've used the site for previous air quality studies and it's known to be typical of many of the city's neighborhoods. Morris also said that a neighborhood setting is a better location to measure benzene than at a busy city intersection.
We kind of wanted to see, you know, what a typical resident might be breathing. And also it's interesting in Anchorage that we found that the levels in some of our neighborhoods are as high, or in some cases higher than they are at intersections, because carbon monoxide and benzene have a common source. It's motor vehicles, and a large portion of motor vehicle emissions occur during cold starts. And typically that's in neighborhoods. It's in the morning.
The interior portion of the study was a collaboration between the department and the University of Alaska Anchorage. It involved about 70 homes scattered across the city.
We actually see much higher levels of benzene inside than outside, especially in homes with attached garages, because people have a habit of storing lawnmowers and chainsaws and snow machines and all kinds of gas-fueled equipment in the garage, and that is always off-gassing a little bit of fuel. Inside that fuel is benzene.
That's why, Morris noted, it's a good idea for people to store such gas-powered gear in a separate shed, if at all possible. All of the Anchorage homes measured had attached garages, and all were involved in a previous study. That study, however, was only a single measurement at each location. This latest effort called for once-a-month readings for an entire year and gave a much more thorough and seasonal profile. Morris says the collected data now provides a good baseline profile of the city's benzene levels before the 2012 reductions from 5 to 1%. Ideally, the department hopes to get funding to conduct a second study on the post-reduction levels at the same locations. That study would probably cost about $200,000, and Morris hoped would be covered by an Environmental Protection Agency grant. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, food as art for a cause.
A model of a dump truck made entirely out of food. There is a model of the 4th Avenue Theater's marquee made out of food.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Indian Trust Land Indian Trust $3.4 billion settlement settlement website amun indiantrust.com amun bu mountain hwal tuklog lugu 1-800-961-6109.
It's a Fur Rondi event that draws engineers, architects, sculptors, and others with an uncanny sense of art and design. And for the past 4 years, this competition has produced creations that wound up on hundreds of tables in homes across Anchorage as well as South Central and rural Alaska.
Gosh, it usually raises between 20 and 30,000 pounds of food, which would be enough for 15 to 20,000 meals. So it is a really important event for us.
Susanna Morgan is executive director of the Food Bank of Alaska. The event is the Food Bank's annual Canstruction contest at Anchorage's University Mall. The idea is to build the most striking structure or sculpture from cans and boxes of food. And because the goal is not only to pursue art, but collect food, the bigger, the better. Morgan says this year's competition attracted about 10 groups and a variety of subjects.
A model of a dump truck made entirely out of food. There is a model of the 4th Avenue Theater's marquee made out of food. There is a wolf howling at the moon. My personal favorite, because of my low sense of humor, was the outhouse made entirely out of food.
The Canstructions undergo two judgments. One is by a panel which includes a judge from the National Canstruction Contest who will see that the local winner advances to the national competition. But there's also the people's choice. That's decided by the number of cans of food that are placed into barrels set by each exhibit. Each item is one vote, and the viewers can vote through tomorrow. And unlike other elections, Morgan says everyone is encouraged to vote as often as they like. Pictures are at our website, aprn.org. Only a handful of mushers from Western Alaska run the Iditarod. One of them, Mike Williams Jr., is from the small Kuskokwim village of Ekyak. He is the son of Iditarod veteran Mike Williams Sr. and shares the same family kennel. Williams Jr. has found a lot of success creating the legacy known as Team Williams. And as Angela Denning Barnes reports, his training style is somewhat unconventional.
Mike Williams Jr. races everything, sprint races and distance races alike, and he always finishes near the top. He took 26th place in his rookie run of the Iditarod last year, and this January he was just 1 minute away from winning the Kuskokwim 300. The 26-year-old Williams is also that good in local sprint races. Last month he won two of them at 25 and 45 miles in length. So how does he do it? This has puzzled his competition, who train their dogs for specific distances and speeds. William says the answer is tough for him to put into words.
I don't know how to explain how dogs do well in short races and then do well in the long races. A good dog's a good dog, and this is a pretty good group.
If you press him, he admits that if he had the resources, he'd have two separate teams, one for sprinting and one for distance, but he has obviously figured out ways to get around that.
If you take care of them right and take care of their feet and manage their weight, you know, keep them at a good weight and not too skinny, not too fat, you know, the dogs can do a lot.
Williams also sees racing the dogs as part of their training. He has seen the benefits of competing in 20-mile races.
I don't know. I think these, you know, pushing them and racing them gets their heart rate up and get their blood flowing, and you know, it gets them in good shape, and you know, overall it's a good exercise for them to expend themselves.
He says it also boils down to the dog's mental strength, which can grow from a variety of training.
A lot of it is mental. Most of it is a mental thing. I'm sure everybody's got, you know, all physically fit dogs, but the mental part of it, you know, it plays a huge role in competition.
William's dogs are in their prime, ranging from 3 to 6 years old. He says nearly all of them ran the Iditarod last year, including his two main leaders, Carrie and Emo. Williams will be wearing Iditarod bib number 41. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The chief of the U.S. Forest Service defended its plan yesterday to reduce the number of 10-year timber sales in Southeast Alaska. Tom Tidwell appeared before the Senate Energy Committee to explain the president's budget request for next year. He admitted to Senator Lisa Murkowski that if the goal is to sustain communities in Southeast, things must change.
And so when I look at what we've been doing in the past in Alaska, it has not worked. We've spent more time in court than we have actually been out on the ground getting work accomplished.
Murkowski is upset because in 2008, the Forest Service promised to have 4-decade-long timber sales in the Tongass of up to 200 million board feet each. But now, instead, it wants to convert 2 of those sales to what are called stewardship contracts and only offer half the board feet in small parcels. Murkowski asked Tidwell what happened to the commitment made by his agency. The director says the goal is to make sure timber harvests go forward.
And I recognize we're not getting enough work done. But I look at what we were doing in 08 and 09, and I look at what we accomplished in 2010, what we plan to accomplish in 2011, what we plan to accomplish in 2012, and the trend's in the right direction. We're building support so that we can actually move forward and get the work accomplished on the ground.
But Murkowski says the second largest remaining mill in Southeast just closed, and the only large mill left is, in her words, desperately worried about its timber supply.
You say that the trend is improving. Going from 600 employees to 6 employees is not a trend
No.
that I want to see. Recognizing that, you know, we've got one remaining large mill. The second largest timber-related construction company is gone. Mm. So to me, these are not trends that I want to continue. I want to take it back the other way.
Senators voiced concerns at the hearing about the Forest Service plan to consolidate some programs and eliminate others. But Tidwell says much of that is only for accounting purposes. The University of Alaska Fairbanks Cooperative Extension Service is making facilities available to small businesses interested in bringing local food to market. KUAC's Lorian Nettleton reports.
Michelle Kisselman is in the test kitchen at the Cooperative Extension Service, tightening the lids on several dozen jars of bright green jalapeno jelly. The jelly is just one of her many flavors of condiments with a kick, available under Kisselman's Glacial Heat brand.
Chipotle plum is not spicy, it's smoky taste. The chipotles are smoky. I have a candy apple jelly, which is more popular with kids. It tastes like candy apples. I have a lemon ginger jelly, which is unique but not spicy. I have some others I can't think of off the top.
Under a new program of the Cooperative Extension Service, local food production entrepreneurs like Kisselman are able to rent time in a Department of Environmental Conservation certified kitchen to make their local food products. This helps relieve some of the cost of starting a business, allowing food producers to focus on getting their products into shopping baskets.
I'd lost my job, was laid off after 12 years, and there aren't that many jobs out there. And I have a son, a little boy. Well, if I can find something I can do on my own and do something I enjoy, and I like to cook, and there isn't a hot sauce company in Fairbanks. So that's great.
Starting a small business frequently requires a leap of faith and a big financial investment. By making their certified kitchen available to local food producers, the Cooperative Extension Service gives entrepreneurs a head start on getting their dreams off the ground.
The cost of building your own kitchen and getting it certified is a lot. And that's why they started this, so that people like me that want to get started can try it out and see how it goes before we start pouring everything we have in our bank accounts and taking multiple mortgages on our house.
The Cooperative Extension is holding an open house on Saturday, March 5th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., providing a chance for people to see the facilities, meet representatives from Cooperative Extension, DEC, and the Alaska Small Business Development Center to discuss their potential business ideas. In Fairbanks, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Most prom queens are teenagers, but at a unique prom held last week in Anchorage, the crowned royalty were middle-aged. That's because these women are convicted criminals. The prom was a chance for them to experience a piece of youth they missed. It was also a way to celebrate a new life after many years behind bars. APRN's Joshua Tucker has the story.
Here come the prom ladies! Here they come, here they come!
The prom is a celebration for three women who are completing their probation and parole. One has survived methamphetamine addiction. All have struggled for years in and out of prison. But tonight, all of that is in the past. Heather Williams is all smiles as she poses for her prom queen picture with her date.
We're the three that are left. I actually am the first woman in New Life. I was the first woman that New Life brought into their program. Then I brought in my sister. Christina came in afterwards, and from there, we've had anywhere from 15 to 30 women come through New Life, and we're the ones that have actually made it through and transitioned forward. Look, baby. I did. I got the crown.
We like dancing.
New Life Development is a program helping ex-offenders to re-enter the community. They are having a ball to mark moving out of the transitional housing facility and into their own apartments. During speeches celebrating the women's growth and transformation, prom queen Darlene Forthenberry is flushed with excitement for the recognition from her mentors at New Life Development.
They gave me the confidence that I needed to be a good person and to raise myself to where I knew I could be. And they saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, and that just makes it even more special because they have a special place in my heart and they always will. They're like my family.
Christina Hare is the third prom queen. She spent 8 months planning the event with Forthenberry and Williams.
Well, we kind of just stuck to what felt right for us as you know, in regards to like decorations and what we wanted it to look like and what we wanted it to feel like for us, because none of us got to go to our prom. So that's, we just kind of stuck together and it worked out well. I mean, it's beautiful in there, and we like it.
At the prom, fedoras are bouncing on the dance floor, while other people relax at tables crisscrossed with rose petals. Eddie Barr is sitting in the corner.
New Life, it's a choice. You have a choice to stay there or not, if you want to be there. I choose to stay for me to change, in order for me to change my lifestyle. I used to be homeless. Now I get to experience a better life for me, like going to these, you know, like prom, for instance, like right here. It's nice, everything's nice looking. You know, I get to dress nice. I feel better. I feel better about myself.
In July of 2009, Barr, an Inupiaq who grew up in Kotzebue, was assaulted on the streets of Anchorage by two young people. The hate crimes incident became infamous when his assailants posted a video of the attack on YouTube. Both are now in prison. But now Barr has invited the man who attacked him, Robert Gum, to join him living at New Life Development when he is released from prison.
I would do all I can to help them learn to change, to help them.
Gum has filed an application from prison to live at the center when he is released. Talking with ex-offenders returning to society reveals a picture of adults struggling through teenage rites of passage for a second time, looking for employment, working to get their driver's licenses back, and even going to prom helps them rejoin the community. For APRN, this is Joshua Tucker.
Voting is another civic right that some felons would like to see restored to them sooner. Currently, many do not have their right to vote restored until they complete their probation and parole, often many years after they are released from prison. Currently, 13 states allow all ex-offenders to vote as soon as they are released. Anchorage Democrat Senator Betty Davis has introduced legislation to restore their right to vote, serve on a jury, and run for office as soon as they are released. Davis hopes that if SB 7 passes, those affected would feel more connected to their community.
Maybe we won't have those people thinking, well, I don't count because I'm a criminal and I shouldn't have the right to vote. I would hope that they would not feel that way about it and be proud of the fact that they would be able to come to the polls and vote if they wanted to.
This is the third time Davis has brought up the bill. In the past, it hasn't made it out of the Senate State Affairs Committee. Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel serves on the committee. She spoke in opposition to the bill at the last hearing on it.
Some of these crimes, while we hope they won't be repeated after release, we know there's a high recidivism rate. The misuse of controlled substances is one of those, sexual abuse, pornography, these all have high recidivism rates. And so to simply say that, well, they're out on probation, let's restore their right to vote, I would have concern about that.
The bill is up for debate again in the Senate's State Affairs Committee on Tuesday. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Lorian Nettleton in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Joshua Tucker from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, committed to supporting communities and Alaska residents beyond just their banking needs. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.